and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, it's Judgment Day in Alabama, as voters head to the polls to choose between the Democrat, former prosecutor Doug Jones, and the Republican, disgraced state Supreme Court Justice Roy Moore. We'll talk about the race's final trends. Next, in a major policy turnaround, the U.S. and Turkey announced that they are willing to accept the fact that Bashar al-Assad will remain as president of Syria. What does that mean for the balance of power in the region? Then, within hours of yesterday's attempted terrorist bombing in New York City, President Trump blamed the incident on immigration and claimed that his proposed policies would have prevented the attack. And then Netflix took to Twitter this week to make a joke about 53 people who watched the same Christmas movie for 18 consecutive days. Funny, right? Not funny at all, actually. It's an admission that Netflix employees have personal access to everything we watch, just like the FBI does through the Patriot Act. And finally, 6 months after one of Britain's worst post-war disasters, the Grenfell Tower fire, in which dozens died and hundreds lost their homes, the Times of London newspaper is attacking activists seeking justice for victims and blaming Russia for trying to stir up class war in the country. Why won't those responsible for the disaster take responsibility? That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the Alabama Senate election. It's Judgment Day in Alabama as voters head to the polls to choose between the Democrat, former prosecutor Doug Jones, and the Republican, former state Supreme Court Justice Roy Moore. We'll talk about the race's final trends. We're joined from Huntsville, Alabama by Lita Gore and from Birmingham, Alabama by Connor Sheets. Both are journalists with AL.com. That's Alabama.com. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lita, let's start with you. This race seems to just go back and forth in the polls, and I think it all comes down to turnout. What does turnout look like so far down there?
Well, our Secretary of State estimated 25%, but we're seeing a higher volume today than what I think a lot of people expected. There are actually lines, which was unheard of in the runoff and in the primary. So I think we're trending upward. Now, what that means for either candidate, we don't know yet. We'll have to wait and see.
Right. It's kind of impossible to say. I mean, 25%, when you think about it, is dismal. But in a special election like this, that's kind of an astronomical sort of turnout. We had a special election here in Northern Virginia about 6 months ago, and we had under 10% turnout. So it's really impossible to make a prediction when turnout's so low like that. Connor, are you seeing the same thing in Birmingham?
So I actually am not currently out talking to people at polls. I'm headed down to Lowndes County, which is in the Black Belt, which is a little bit poorer section of the state, one of the poorer counties, and majority Black area, so a little bit different than the area that Lita's currently looking at. But apparently, I'll be headed down there to drive around with a woman who is driving people to polls, elderly people and other people who have trouble getting to the polls. And she's saying that her phone's ringing off the hook with people needing rides and that there's lines everywhere she goes. So it sounds like that's the case in other parts of the state as well.
Well, for Doug Jones, I mean, it would seem, I mean, we're at a distant place here, so we might be wrong. I mean, very possibly wrong. But it would seem that the turnout from the Black community would be, in fact, decisive. Do you see it that way?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a couple demographics, obviously. Women are going to be decisive as well. But I think, yeah, without the Black vote, I don't see any path to victory for Doug Jones.
You know, one of the interesting things about this race, too, is that being a special election, the winner is only going to actually serve for about 1 year. And then there's going to be another election in November 2018 for the same seat. Do you see the bitterness of this race? And I'm asking Lita to start off. Do you see the bitterness of this race carrying over into the next election in 2018?
Well, I think the bitterness from 2016 certainly carried over into this election. We've not seen a let up from the presidential race. And in some ways, this is a carryover. In a lot of ways, this is such a strange race for people in Alabama. We don't normally have a true general election. Most races are decided in the primary, with the Republican primary being the preeminent one, and then the general election can sometimes be an afterthought. This is rare, not just because it's a special election, but because it's an actual race. between two separate parties.
Yeah, there hasn't been a race between the two parties in Alabama in something like a decade. But, you know, one of the things, Brian Becker, that the mainstream media is ignoring is what has this race done to the Alabama Republican Party? Luther Strange was a guy that, by all accounts, everybody liked. He was a good attorney general. He was popular within the establishment of the party, and he was unceremoniously dumped in the Republican primary with Roy Moore winning that nomination. So what is this doing? Let's turn to Connor. What is this doing to the Alabama Republican Party? What kind of battles are going to continue in this party as they head into the 2018 Senate election?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say, but I mean, we have a governor's race coming up in not too long. And as you're saying, we have the election again next year. And I think heading into that, it will be interesting to see how the fault lines from this line continue forward. Obviously, we have Roy Moore, who's a very, very socially conservative Christian wing of the party, you know, sort of evangelical Baptist type of side of the party. And that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out against some of the younger, newer voters who are coming in with a totally different perspective. And it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out in the next election, who ends up being triumphant as their next nominee in the next statewide election.
We were just watching on TV Roy Moore showing up to vote on a horse.
Yeah.
Yeah, he always does that.
I only saw it without the was that what that was?
Yeah, it came on a horse.
And one of the horses is named Sassy, just so you know.
Oh, priceless.
Go ahead, Lita.
Well, I was just going to say one thing to keep in mind, too, is that if Roy Moore is victorious, he goes to the Senate with Richard Shelby, our longtime senator, Republican senator, who came out very quickly and said he would not support Roy Moore and did not vote for Roy Moore. And what I find fascinating about that is our state Republican Party, who stayed with Moore even when the National Republican Party abandoned him for that brief period of time, the state Republican Party had come out and said, we will punish, we will not support any Republican in this state who supports another candidate or who supports a write-in vote. Well, 24 hours later, Richard Shelby comes out and says, okay, thanks, I did a write-in vote. And so there's really no blowback on Richard Shelby, because what are you going to do to this longtime senator with millions in his war chest? And so it sort of left the Republican Party looking rather neutralized as far as in the state, because they've made a threat or a indication that they would not support a Republican who spoke out against their nominee, and then you had their most high-profile Republican do just that. So now now you've got Roy Moore joining Richard Shelby in the Senate if Moore's victorious today, and there's an obvious disconnect right there from the start.
Let me ask both of you very quickly. One, who do you expect to win today, if you have a sense of that? And two, Connor, I'm just looking at your article. It's entitled, In Final Hour Order, Court Rules That Alabama Can Destroy Digital Voting Records After All. So maybe before we talk about your own crystal ball, what's that all about and how important is that?
So over the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot of chatter just sort of about the integrity of the election process. There were questions after Georgia's congressional election earlier this year. Apparently some records were destroyed. And so the situation was four voters across the state of Alabama joined together and sued the state, asking that they maintain these digital digital images of the voting records. And yesterday, the circuit court ruled that the state had to maintain those records. And then a couple hours later, the state Supreme Court went ahead and overturned that. And now the state does not have to maintain those records. So there's a lot of attention that, going on with that.
Is there a political significance to that? I mean, it seems an odd decision not to retain records when we've had so many disputed elections, not just in the last election, but, for the last couple decades. What's the politics there, if there are politics?
I mean, I think it's almost too soon to say what the politics are. I think there's clearly a play going back and forth. I mean, so the Secretary of State, John Merrill, is a Republican who's come out and said that he supports Roy Moore. He's the one who filed the emergency brief, I guess, yesterday, asking for this release, asking for them to stay the decision. So he's put himself out as sort of a political figure in that sense, and then now he's kind of weighing in this way. So I don't know what the politics actually are, but there's definitely some optics issues.
Indeed. Let's go to we have about 90 seconds left. For both of you, how do you expect this election to turn out? And based on your own prediction, what do you think the impact will be there where you are in Alabama?
I don't have a specific prediction of who's going to win. I do think it's going to be a very tight race. I think we're going to see not a very wide margin, but that could obviously be incorrect. I think, you know, as far as the fallout, I think it's going to be massive. I think either side is going to be upset if the other side wins. It's going to be very interesting to see how it shakes out in national politics and for the state.
Go ahead, Lita.
More about 5 to 7 points. And we're not done with dealing with Roy Moore in the Senate and what's going to happen once he's actually elected, if he's elected.
You know, I have to agree with that. I think that a Democrat to win in Alabama right now is a bridge too far for the Democrats. And Roy Moore, with all of his negatives, with all of his problems, he's got the numbers there.
He's got Trump. And it is about turnout, ultimately, for Doug Jones under these circumstances to prevail. 15 seconds left, Connor. You get the last word.
I'd just say, you know, I think it's going to be very interesting as we see the results coming in. And we're all just very glad in Alabama that this is coming to a close, however it does end. It's been quite the ride.
Indeed, indeed. Okay, we're out of time, John. We've been joined from Alabama by Lita Gore and Connor Sheets. Lita was talking to us from Huntsville, Alabama. Connor was talking from Birmingham. Both are journalists with AL.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In a major policy turnaround, the U.S. and Turkey announced that they are willing to accept the fact that Bashar al-Assad will remain as the president of Syria. What does that mean for the balance of power in the region? We're joined from London by Peter Ford. He is the former UK ambassador to Syria. Peter, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
This is a major policy change. At least it is here in the U.S. I would call it major also in Turkey. But, you know, the United States made such a production, really since 2009, of regime change in Syria, and that policy has fallen apart. What do you make of this?
Well, I'd like to look at the small print first. The U.S. Has come close to saying this before, but there's always a rider, like they say, yeah, Assad can stay for now, or at this stage, or until 2021, when elections are due in Syria. And I suspect this leap is not actually such a major step. They've been gradually creeping towards it, crab-like, and now they've just made one little more step back into the world of reality, because the rest of the world has known for a long time that Assad is not going anywhere.
I'd like to get your take, too, on something that I've always struggled with. I spent many years at the CIA. I did a rotation to the State Department, two of them, actually. I was on the staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and I was never actually clear as to the basis of the animosity between the United States and Syria, other than Bashar al-Assad would not allow the United States overflight permission when we decided to attack Iraq. Is it that simple, or am I missing something here?
I think it goes back much further. Washington has been waging effectively a 40-year war on Syria. It goes back to the time of Hafez, Bashar's father. Hafez, of course, was firmly in those days in the Soviet camp when there was a Soviet Union and we had the Cold War. The animosity goes back to that. There have been intervals when relations have picked up to some degree, but there have, for example, during the very early days of Bashar al-Assad, but that was a fleetingly brief honeymoon. And it's clear since at least the time of 9/11 that regime change in Syria, as well as several other Arab countries, has been on the U.S. Radar.
Syria tried to cooperate with the United States after 9/11 and did cooperate.
It did indeed, yes.
Talk about that.
It did. It helped in the war for the liberation of Kuwait, but the U.S. was always grudging in its acceptance of Syrian help. And, you know, underlying it all, there is Israel. I'm sorry to say, but so much of the animosity, it appears, can be traced back to the fact that Syria has remained a holdout against the Arab drift towards normalization with Syria. It's been odd man out virtually for years and years on that, and it's also been odd man out on kowtowing simply to the United States. Basically, if you're an Arab leader, you can get away with anything with the United States. You can send 15 of your fellow countrymen to blow up the Twin Towers, and nothing happens to you as long as officially you kowtow. But Assad and Syria would never do that.
But let me just ask you, Ambassador Ford, I mean, during the first Gulf War, I mean, Syrian planes actually flew with the other U.S. and other allied planes. I don't think they flew a lot, but they did carry out bombing missions of Iraq, though. I mean, in other words, there were periods where there was some degree of collaboration or a congruence of perceived interest, perhaps is a better way of saying it.
Yeah, there was a tactical collusion. Remember, there was no love lost between the two fascist regimes of Syria and Iraq. The Syrians were very glad to see the back of Saddam, who'd been niggling them for years and years. So Syria wasn't doing this purely out of the goodness of its heart. It was a congruence of interests, a fleeting coincidence of objectives.
One thing that occurred to me, and I'd like to get your opinion, Ambassador, is that the United States, because it's been the dominant power in this resource-rich, geostrategically important region for so long, following the collapse of the Soviet bloc, and after... Well, when George W. Bush came into office, then went ahead following September 11th with the shock and awe invasion of Iraq, clearly showing that the U.S. could take down an Arab army and an Arab government very quickly. And so they were kind of filled with hubris and arrogance. And then Libya came along in 2011, and the protest movement that began in Benghazi was quickly taken advantage of as a pretext to bring that government down. It seemed to me that there was just such a sense by U.S. administration policymakers that they could do whatever they wanted to do in this important region, that they were sure then that they could knock off Assad. In other words, just a sense of arrogance.
Arrogance, yes.
Like, and just thinking at the beginning, well, if we say he must go, undoubtedly he will go. In other words, no one can stand up. No one can survive once the U.S. has targeted some regime for change. What, could it be that simple? Like, or in other words, not that simple, but in other words, that would be sort of the operational principle of having made this grave, turns out catastrophic error in U.S. policy?
Well, I think the mindset was revealed in that casual remark by Hillary Clinton that we've all seen. We came, we saw, he died, apropos of Gaddafi and Libya. Lightheartedly, vicious, evil remark. Yeah, that was the mindset, and it's certainly bipartisan. Can't say that the Democrats are much better than the Republicans in this department. It is arrogance. It's imperial hubris.
Yeah, just feeling you can do something because you can do something. And, you know, Robert Gates, who was the Secretary of Defense for Bush and then Obama, made the point at the beginning of the Libya conflict that he didn't see Libya as vital to U.S. interests, meaning he was sort of saying, don't do this. And Obama was attacked by the Washington Post editorial board, the neocon editorial board, for being the, quote, passive president. You had Hillary Clinton and the French, Hollande, demanding that the war happen. So the cautious side of the U.S. policy establishment sort of was cautious in terms of providing any sort of real opposition. And so those who were the most vigorous, most robust for intervention did it. And I think they were just so happy after Libya that they could destroy this government that they had not liked for a long time, ever since it came to power in 1969. I think they just felt like, hey, we're on a roll. Nobody's going to stop us.
That's right. But you know, there's another element here. It's Iran. Iran is in a slightly different category, not being Arab and being a bigger mouthful to bite off than any Arab government. And Iran is a strong ally of Syria. This is another reason for the animosity towards Syria, that striking Syria was a way of getting at Iran. Now, Iran does pose a sort of existential threat because it's God to the U.S. Satan in their terminology. And it has a powerful ideology of its own, or it did back in the late 70s and 80s. And it has never been prepared to knuckle down. You know, it's a big country.
Yeah, that's an important issue. I wonder if the Syrians see themselves as really just a proxy between the Americans and the Iranians, you know, and then you have the Saudis and the Egyptians sniping from the sidelines that Assad has to go, and then the Turks on top of that. I wonder if this really, I mean, it doesn't have to be the Syrians. It could be any country. It finds itself in the middle of the Iranians and the Americans.
That's right, although the Syrians have never been under any illusions that they were not loved by the U.S. with or without Iran. They made effectively a tactical alliance with Iran because they had to. Back in the days when I was ambassador in Damascus, I remember Syrian ministers pleading with me, "Why are you pushing us into the camp of Iran? We are a secular state. Iran is Islamist. We don't like turbans and beards. Why are you pushing us?" So we have no alternative but to seek help from these people.
Very interesting.
And very important as well. And you know what? I could, in my mind, I can picture that conversation taking place. I'm sure that that's true. I'm sure that the Syrians have been bewildered over the years as to American policy.
Yeah, they say literally, you know, we're like you. You know, our women wear skirts in Latakia and Damascus.
It's true.
We're more like you. We really don't understand it.
I have to say, before we wrap up, John, the last time I was in Iraq, which was in 2002, I was with Ramsey Clark, and we were going all over the country, wherever the U.S. was then bombing, and the U.S. was bombing every day. And we were in the hospitals and in the drugstores, and the pharmacies actually, after 13 years, were suddenly having some medicine, and yet now the bombing was beginning. And the Iraqis, too, asked us, "Why are you doing this? What's going on? Why, you know, we don't want to be against the United States." And, you know, I think the Iraqis and the Syrians were probably just perplexed by this focus, this animus, this constant hostility.
Indeed. And to this day, there is the genuine bewilderment, but resignation and acceptance. There are no illusions that Syria is ever going to be in Uncle Sam's good books. And even if today the news might be that America grudgingly accepts that the Syrian government is here to stay, the Syrians don't believe that will remain valid for very long.
We will have to leave that as the last word. That was Ambassador Peter Ford joining us from London. He's the former UK ambassador to Syria. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Within hours of yesterday's attempted terrorist bombing in New York City, President Trump blamed the incident on immigration and claimed that his proposed policies would have prevented the attack. We're joined from New York by Angie Kim, an immigrant rights advocate and community organizer with the Minh Quan Center for Community Action. Welcome back, Angie.
Thank you.
You know, if it wasn't Donald Trump, we'd think like, wow, that's an absurd statement. But it is Donald Trump. Anyway, go ahead, Angie.
I totally agree with you. I can't really say that I'm surprised to hear the statement. It's almost expected, I think, at this point. But again, you know, my comment on his response to yesterday's attack, which, you know, I am here in New York City, and it was a scary moment, and it happened during a very busy morning commute. And, you know, I also had to call my parents and check on my family to see if they're okay. And we all share that fear and that that concern for terrorism in the modern day. But, you know, again, his comment on sort of pivoting the issue of extreme ideology and terrorist groups and linking that to the issue of immigration in the United States is just completely absurd. And it's just not true.
So the person who's alleged to have committed the attack was born in Bangladesh. He's 27 now. 6 years ago is when he came to the United States when he was 21 years old. I mean, considering, you know, the development of ISIS, which he's alleged to have been inspired by 6 years ago, I mean, it would seem to me like almost certainly he was radicalized and won over to ISIS's philosophy. I mean, ISIS didn't really exist in its current form even 6 years ago. That must have happened in the United States, right? I mean, it has nothing to do with, you know, Bangladesh, the country.
No, it doesn't. And if we were to also link his comments about how his policy could have prevented yesterday's attack, first of all, Bangladesh is not even part of the Muslim countries that are included in his recent travel ban that he issued over three times. So I don't see any connection there. And you know, most importantly, the point that I want to make is that I think it's a very dangerous thing for any person, especially people in power, to generalize any incidents or the act of a person as the motivation of a group of people. We've seen that in history and civilization, where that idea, that belief is used to attack an entire group of people, nation, and that's sometimes how war gets started. I think that it's important to isolate this incident, or any incident for that matter, and look at it with a more subjective view.
So Donald Trump talks about chain migration. I mean, it's one of his favorite phrases to use. I mean, how do people in the immigrant rights communities refer to that process? I mean, chain migration makes it sound like it's this scary, you know, invasion that never stops. But chain migration is about families reunifying, right?
Absolutely. Chain migration is a pretty recent word that's been thrown around, especially by the Trump administration. And it does have a very negative connotation where it sort of gives immigrants a stereotype of someone who's sort of they're leakers and seekers who are probing into the country. But family, essentially what Donald Trump is referring to as a chain migration, immigration is a immigration policy in the United States where families, you know, parents and children, wives and husband, be united and move to the country to build a life together. That's essentially what a family-based visa petitions are. But the way that Trump administration again is utilizing these rhetorics is to give the current immigration system a false view where the immigration itself is creating a national insecurity. They are motivating terrorists to come to the United States and create a ruckus. That's just completely not true.
The president of the United States has a lot of influence, and it's not just his ability to sign bills into law. Not only about the way the executive branch functions, he sets a tone politically. And Bangladesh is a country of 163 million people. It's in South Asia. It used to be East Pakistan. A lot of people in the United States who are not from that region won't really know much about Bangladesh. But what Donald Trump is trying to do is create a sense of hatred against Asians, against Muslims, against Arabs, against non-white populations. And it's a political tool. And, you know, when you think about it, Walter, we had the Asian Exclusion Act of 1882 that was...
Chinese Exclusion Act.
I mean, at that time, mobs formed, vigilante mobs. There were massacres, many massacres. There was the Rock Springs Massacre of 1885, the Snake River Massacre of 1887. The way, quote, Chinatowns were created in a major urban areas were because of the exodus created by the fervor, the hatred, the lynch mob mentality that sort of ran over the United States, not just during that decade, but it went on for decades and decades and maybe still continues. And here you have Donald Trump appealing to the worst in American history, again, for opportunist political purposes. Nothing in Donald Trump's immigration policy or his ban would have stopped this attack. And at the same time, the United States is bombing mostly Muslim countries, carrying out drone strikes against mainly Muslim countries. I mean, why might that not be a part of the so-called radicalization of young Muslims in New York or anywhere?
I think it's absolutely part of that, and it becomes both a justification. Well, it becomes a major rationale behind those ongoing and endless, seemingly endless war on terrorism, so-called, that's now come to include not just Afghanistan and Iraq, where there were large numbers and still are large numbers of U.S. ground forces deployed, but it's become this proliferating conflict all across, you're right, primarily the Muslim world in Somalia and Yemen and Libya, all of these different countries in Pakistan, certainly, where there are horrible drone bombings being carried out. So there's clearly a political motivation for all of this.
Okay, Angie, you get the last word, about 45 seconds left. You're in New York. Again, we're glad that you and your family and so many people were safe as a consequence. But the ripple effect of these kind of incidents doesn't stop. Go ahead.
Absolutely, it doesn't. And I also want to point out that if we are going to talk about these incidences as an individual situations, we've also had recently, a massive killings. I mean, you know, just recently, Stephen Paddock, right,
in Las Vegas,
shot over 546 people, about 60 of them died in Vegas, and the president and the Republicans decide to let it by one of the deadliest mass shootings in modern American history with a wink and a nod.
Excellent point.
I think that just goes to show the narrow-mindedness and their willingness to portray this as, like you said, for their own political agendas.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from New York by Angie Kim. She is an immigrant rights advocate and community organizer with the Minh Quan Center for Community Action. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou here in the studio in Washington with my colleague Brian Becker. Netflix took to Twitter this week to make a joke about 53 people who watched the same Christmas movie for 18 consecutive days. Funny, right? Well, not funny at all, actually. It's an admission that Netflix employees have personal access to everything we watch, just like the FBI does through the Patriot Act. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, John, Brian, thanks for having me on.
Chris, here's what Netflix tweeted. To the 53 people who have watched A Christmas Prince every day for the past 18 days, who hurt you? That was supposed to be funny. Grant Hamilton, a Twitter user, tweeted back to the Netflix employee who recently watched 1984. It's not an instruction manual. I have to say, I'm with this Grant Hamilton, whoever he is. This creeps me out, to tell you the truth. I feel like we don't have very much at all in the way of personal privacy anymore. If the FBI is not watching us through the Patriot Act, now Netflix is watching us and watching what we watch. What do you think about that?
I think you're completely right. I think that other tweeter is completely right as well. And if it's the FBI, CIA, NSA aren't watching us, well, they're asking these companies to do it for us. As Edward Snowden released, you know, we know that the government intelligence agencies work very closely with companies like Facebook, Twitter, Google, and many others to keep track of this information. We are in this era of big data, where everything we do online is tracked, right down to watching A Christmas Prince every day for 18 days straight. So it might seem innocuous, but it's actually very telling that Netflix has this information. And I think we need to point out, too, that it's not just Netflix that does this. Spotify, at the end of November, launched a new ad campaign for 2018. They're calling it 2018 Goals. They're putting up billboards across all across the country, actually across the world. For example, be as savage as the person who made the 1 hour, 55 minute playlist called Lasting Longer Than the Mooch. Or deliver burns as well as the person who streamed Bad Liar 86 times the day Sean Spicer resigned. So these are, you know, they're funny, they're catching, they're politically charged. But how does Spotify know that somebody streamed Bad Liar 86 times the day that Sean Spicer resigned? They're tracking all of that data about us.
They are. They're tracking all of that data. You know, and this is becoming the norm, which is what I fear. Alexa. I don't even know, Brian, how would you even describe Alexa? It's that machine you talk into and tell it to turn on Netflix for you or Amazon or whatever.
I just know her as Alexa. I don't know how to describe Alexa.
But Alexa.
But Chris might know.
And Alexa is spying on us. Siri is spying on us. There was a recent case where a local police department was able to subpoena Alexa to look through its memory and to see if this person accused of a crime had actually used Alexa to help plot out the crime. But here we have the technology in our own homes.
If you have a smart TV and you turn the TV off, guess what?
That's right.
It's not off.
It's not off. And it's listening to you.
That's right. In fact, if you have a smartphone and you turn it off, part of the WikiLeaks Vault 7 releases from earlier this year showed us that the NSA has the ability to infect your phone to the point that if it's turned off, they can still access the microphone and transmit whatever's being said over the internet back to their servers to monitor your conversations. So even though you've turned your phone off, it can still monitor you. Same thing for TVs, same thing for the Alexa. I don't have a, I have an iPhone. I don't have an Alexa. I don't have a Google Home, anything like that. It's, you know, they used to say that if you, you know, people would be paranoid about the government wiretapping their phones, but now we've put the wiretaps in our homes.
Yes, we actually bought the wiretaps and installed them ourselves.
We're paying for the privilege, yeah.
So the Netflix US, that's their Twitter account, they tweeted, to the 53 people who watched A Christmas Prince every day for the past 18 days, who hurt you?
Right.
And then Twitter lit up because obviously this is not a robot that details customer preferences. There's somebody actually tracking this. That's not a robot, right? Right,
no.
Chris? That's, in other words, these are Netflix employees. Some, I don't know, 25-year-old who's going through and able to aggregate and then specify with particularity who's watching what and then tweeting about it. In other words, it's like that.
Sure. There was some social media person, some marketing person who went through the data and caught this. But the thing is, there are essentially robots, machines, aggregating all of this information. It's coming in faster than any single person could ever look through it. You know, every time somebody looks at Netflix, plays something, even hits pause and rewinds during a show, they track that. In fact, we should talk. This is how they decided to make House of Cards. They realized that some of the most popular films and popular parts of films that people watched on Netflix involved Kevin Spacey. Now we see, you know, how that's ended up, but that's actually what motivated them to make House of Cards.
Wow. I don't think I had ever heard that before.
Yeah, and that's how they're now saying this is how Netflix's surveillance capacity and their capacity to watch what we watch, and because we are the products.
Right.
You know, they're not selling us the products, we are the products. This is a kind of surveillance capitalism where we are ourselves the target. In other words, we're the commodity. And so they were able to surveil, they're able to determine what people are watching and then craft and design things that would feed into customer preferences. I'm looking at something that says, it's the TC website, and it says, the first rule of surveillance capitalism is you don't talk about surveillance capitalism. The second rule of surveillance capitalism is you definitely don't talk about surveillance capitalism if you're actually talking cold hard cash from users of your market. That is, not simply charging them via your ability to rinse their likes and dislikes out of their personal data to fuel your ad targeting engine. TC is criticizing Netflix for having produced the tweet that allowed these people to know and allowed us, the whole public, to know that, in fact, Netflix is watching everything we do and is able to surveillance and comment on it. In other words, a foolish move by Netflix.
It is a foolish move, and I'm glad people are up in arms about this. But again, this is not something that's just Netflix does. You know, we give Netflix money, we give Spotify money, and especially the companies that we don't give money to, like Facebook. The dating site OkCupid puts out regular reports on what people are looking for and what people are into and dating trends in different states. This is all this data that's being collected on us. It used to be said that if you're not paying for it, you are the product. And that's true in the case of something like Facebook and Twitter. But now, even if you are paying for it, surveillance capitalism makes you the product anyway, because this isn't just going to government agencies. It's going to hundreds and thousands of companies who tailor ads to the individual viewer. So the information that Netflix has actually gets fed into aggregated data that ties into what Amazon has on you and Facebook and all these other companies, so that next time you do a search online, you see ads for things that they think you're particularly interested in.
Yeah, and I get that. I don't necessarily like it or have to like it, I suppose, but I understand that. What I don't understand, what's creepy to me, is these were human beings at Netflix that pulled this information out, thought that they would make a joke, and just made it weird for everybody. You know, that's what bothers me, because we're also aware of the surveillance state right now, and this just makes it worse.
And let's just also talk about, if this is the government seizing our information, you know, it would be a violation of the Fourth Amendment. But what's happening, Chris, is that we're providing this information to these companies, to these corporations that are driven by profit and only profit. That's why they're in business. We're giving the information because we sort of have to give them the information if we want to access those parts of the internet, which are now considered to be absolutely a requirement for modern civilian life. And then they say, well, you've given us your data, thus we can own your data. You are complicit with your own sort of divergence of your private information to us, and thus we are no longer obligated. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're definitely right, Brian. And I think the further danger of all this data collection is, you know, we've seen so many security breaches, the biggest one being the Equifax breach from earlier this year, where millions of social security numbers, credit histories, addresses, driver's license numbers, all this personal information have been leaked by hackers. And that's really one of the most dangerous things about this. But I think, too, we have to talk about the role the government can and does play in this. I was talking to somebody this morning about this tweet, and we brought up the idea that, you know, it used to be a little over a decade ago when George W. Bush introduced the Patriot Act and, you know, the Congress, you know, nearly unanimously passed it. It was librarians that were one of the leading forces against that surveillance state. I remember, you know, I was getting politically involved at the time. And it was a librarian saying, we're not going to let the government go through library records.
Yeah, they stood up.
Now the Netflix employees are saying, hey, here are these records. Here's this aggregate data, but we can certainly give you the names of the 53 people who have watched this 18 days in a row. We need to really revive the movement for civil liberties, especially when it comes to online communications, because as you said, it is such a necessary part of day-to-day life at this point.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Chris Garafa with the last word. Chris Garafa is a web developer and technologist. He joined us from New Haven, Connecticut, talking about Netflix and privacy. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
6 months after one of Britain's worst post-war disasters, in which dozens of people died and hundreds more lost their homes, the Times newspaper is attacking activists seeking justice for the victims and blaming Russia for trying to stir up class war in the country. Why won't those responsible for the Grenfell disaster take responsibility? We're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, welcome back to the show.
Delighted to be with you.
Is it true, Alexander, where you are, Russia? Russia's responsible for Grenfell?
Well, it most certainly is not Russia that is responsible for Grenfell. All sorts of people are responsible for Grenfell. We've not had the full investigation in yet, but it's clear that we have a long pattern of things going wrong, extending back over many years, with all sorts of systems failures building up. And the people we can definitely say were not involved were the Russians. There's lots of people in Britain, in the local council, in the building community, in the government, in the regulatory bodies. They certainly were involved. And one can also say, I think without any hesitation at all, that the entire economic and social system in Britain was also involved. So when RT talks about, or when people talk about class issues, I don't actually know whether RT did, but if class issues were brought up, they should have been brought up because they are actually relevant to what happened.
The way this story is unfolding, John, the Times in UK,
yes.
Times newspaper.
Owned by Rupert Murdoch, by the way.
Yeah. A bastion of accuracy. They say, quote, a Kremlin-controlled TV station seized on the Grenfell Tower fire to foment class war in Britain. You know, here when you go back to what the U.S. is also now charging, what the Mueller investigation, or at least the House committee or Senate committee or whoever's leaking, because they're all leaking, they're also asserting that people who are fighting against police violence, the Black Lives Matter movement,
right,
people fighting for LGBT rights, all of these are sort of social movements that somehow Russia waved a wand and created. So, like, I guess Russia is to blame for everything.
Yeah, if they spent as much time trying to fix society's ills as they do blaming the Russians for everything, all of society's ills, maybe we wouldn't have those ills in the first place.
Well, I think that is a very profound point, if I may say, because it's now becoming, Russia is becoming the alibi that is being used to explain away things when they go wrong. And of course, in the case of the Times and its coverage of Grenfell Tower, also to excuse the fact that nothing is being done to put those things which went wrong right. So, rather than fix the problem, you blame Russia instead. And we see this in problem after problem, which is arising. I mean, if we talk about the US election and the outcome there, many people didn't like it, so blame Russia for it.
Alexander, let's talk about the fire at Grenfell Tower for a minute, in case our listeners don't know what happened. This took place just recently on the 14th of June, 2017. Grenfell Tower was a 24-story block of public housing. It was in North Kensington, a lovely area in West London. But there were poor people in Grenfell Tower. These were people who, many of whom were on government assistance. It was subsidized housing. And it suddenly caught fire, and it burned. It really burned. It says here in one of the articles that covered the fire, the rapid growth of the fire is thought to have been accelerated by the building's exterior cladding, which is a common type in widespread use. An independent review of building regulations and fire safety is still in progress. We said in our introduction, 71 people died, mostly of smoke inhalation, and there were hundreds of people injured. So why is it that the British government and or the British media is looking outside that government for boogeymen in this disaster?
Yes. I mean, there is obviously a huge political dimension here. I mean, there's a few things I think which our listeners need to understand. First of all, Kensington is one of the richest areas of London and indeed of the world. It is equivalent to the Upper East Side, basically, of New York. It is an extremely rich area. As happens with some very, very rich areas, there are some very poor people who live there. And there are also apartment buildings, and Grenfell Tower is one apartment building, which are very neglected and old not in particularly good shape, and to which poor people are decanted. They're basically put there so that they're cleared away from sight, essentially, and are not visible to the rich people who otherwise live in Kensington. And, of course, the local authority, the local government in Kensington, which is Conservative-controlled and very close to the government and has always been influential within the Conservative Party, has always been more concerned with keeping the rich people who live in Kensington pleased rather than the poor people who keep them pleased. So this is something that became very visible in the hours and days following the fire. And it is a big political issue in London, which is a complicated and important city with lots of different political views, but which is decisive in determining the political future of this country. So it put the political establishment in Britain very much on the political defensive. And as I said previously, rather than examine what happened, which would lead to serious questions being asked about itself and about the way it operates, the British establishment, the British political and conservative establishment, prefers to look outward, blame other people, talk about class war, point the fingers at RT, point the fingers at Russia, blame Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, and by association suggest he's involved, and do that.
RT had an opinion piece today on its website, in which it tries to go through the events as they happened, leading to what I'm calling a scandal here. It says that an RT reporter reported that £10 million was spent on cosmetic changes to the outside of the building to make it look better for wealthy residents who lived nearby. In fact, the £10 million figure was the cost of the entire refurbishment of the building between 2014 and 2016, not just the cladding. And then the reporter went on to ask a question of a British government official, and he asked if state-backed neglect, corruption, and cuts to services had been what led to the fire and the government's response to the fire. It was then that the Times, as I said, owned by Rupert Murdoch, said that this was a Russian plot to destabilize British society, that anyone asking questions about the fire, the causes of the fire, had to be working for the Russians. I mean, this is the situation we find ourselves in, and not just in the UK. We see this in the United States every single day. We see it in the National Defense Authorization Act, which President Trump signed into law today, which allows cable television carriers to drop RT. God forbid anybody should be exposed to information, because information can be dangerous, apparently.
Yes, well, I think it is more evolved, actually, in the US than it is in Britain. I think we're starting to go down that road. And articles like the one we've talked about in the Times are examples of this. But it is unquestionably the case that in the US there is a concerted campaign against what I can only call free speech. And again, the thread that's been used to link all the people who are engaging in free speech, who other people want to suppress together, is Russia. So you somehow argue that if you are complaining or asking questions, that means that the Kremlin has put you up to do it. And that is an extremely dangerous thing to do at many levels. It is very dangerous for democracy when free speech is being suppressed. It is very dangerous for the efficient functioning of society when dissident views are being suppressed. And it is very dangerous also when another country is being blamed by you for your own problems.
Alexander, an investigation that was done by the British government was completed just recently, and its report was published. There was a fascinating quote in this report. It says that RT's reporting is influential in the Grenfell Tower neighborhood. Lucy Knight, a volunteer in the area, told The Times, "People get their news from all kinds of places, such as Al Jazeera and RT," she said. "There's a sort of general feeling that the BBC don't have quite the approach they used to in terms of journalism." Do you see that as a trend in the UK? We've got about 30 seconds left.
I would say that it is a trend, and not just in the UK, unfortunately. It is a trend all over the West. Again, most advanced of all in the United States. What I will say is that British journalism at one time, as I remember it, had a much more rigorous approach to facts than it appears to have any longer today. And the deterioration is becoming more marked all the time. And I'm afraid the Grenfell Tower episode is just a minor one.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been speaking with Alexander Mercuris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Deran. We've been talking to Alexander from London. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia, Maryland area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, between 4 and 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.
La 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 la